Echelon, and Tempest. Though GPS and surveillance systems are reasons for serious concern, the two greatest electronic threats to American privacy and individual freedom are Echelon and Tempest. "The secret is out," wrote Jim Wilson in Popular Mechanics, two powerful intelligence gathering tools that the United States created to eavesdrop on Soviet leaders and to track KGB spies are now being used to monitor Americans. Echelon is a global eavesdropping satellite network and massive supercomputer system that operates from the National Security Agency's headquarters in Maryland. It intercepts and analyzes phone calls, faxes, and emails sent to and from the United States, both with or without encryption. Encrypted messages are first decrypted and then joined with clear messages. The NSA then checks all messages for trigger words with software known as Dictionary. Terms like nuclear bomb, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, anthrax, and so on are then shuttled to appropriate agencies for analysis. Although speculation and warning about Echelon were circulating on the Internet for a number of years, it was not until 2001 that the U.S. government finally admitted the program's existence. This admission came after high-profile investigations in Europe discovered that Echelon had been used to spy on the two European companies, Airbus Industries and Thomson CSF. Though the U.S. government revealed Echelon's use in 2001, the government had been using an early version of Echelon in the late 1960s and 1970s. During that time, Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon used NSA technology to gather files on thousands of American citizens and more than 1,000 organizations opposed to the Vietnam War. In a program called Operation Shamrock, the NSA collected and monitored nearly every international telegram sent from New York. Although paid for primarily by U.S. taxpayers, Echelon is now multinational and involves nations like the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and even Italy and Turkey. Most of the information that comes from Echelon goes to the CIA. According to Popular Mechanics Wilson, based on what is known about the location of Echelon bases and satellites, it is estimated that there is a 90% chance that NSA is listening when you pick up the phone to place or answer an overseas call. In theory, but obviously not in practice, Echelon's supercomputers are so fast they could identify Saddam Hussein by the sound of his voice the moment he begins speaking on the phone. Amazing as all this technology may sound, because the government now acknowledges its existence may mean that it is phasing the program out for another technology. The next system that the government uses may be a ground-based technology known as Tempest. To prevent your computer from causing static on your neighbor's TV, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, certifies all electronic and electrical equipment. Tempest, or Telecommunications Electronics Material Protected from Emanating Spurious Transmissions technology, stemmed from simply shielding electronic equipment to prevent interference with nearby devices. But in the process of preventing unwanted electronic signals, researchers learned how to pick up signals at a distance. Advances in Tempest technology mean that somewhere out there, someone may be able to secretly read the displays on machines like personal computers, cash registers, television sets, and automated teller machines, ATMs, without the person using those machines knowing it. Jim Wilson wrote that documents now available from foreign governments and older sources clearly show how these systems are used to invade our right to privacy. We think you will agree it also creates a real and present threat to our freedom. In September 2002, the Associated Press obtained U.S. government documents that showed that the Bush administration would create a fund that would combine tax dollars with funds from the technology industry to pay for Internet Security Enhancements. Under the title Executive Summary for the National Strategy to Secure Cyberspace, the documents discussed sweeping new obligations on companies, universities, federal agencies, and home users to make the Internet more secure, presumably from terrorists. This new Internet strategy was headed up by Richard Clark, formerly a top counterterrorism expert in both the Bush and Clinton administrations, and Howard Schmidt, a former senior executive at Microsoft Corporation. When released in 2003, the plan offered more than 80 recommendations for tightening Internet security. The Cybersecurity Act of 2009. One reason the globalists want to shut down the free flow of information is that it interferes with their fear-mongering and socio-political manipulation. With the introduction of Senate Bills number 773 and 778 by Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia, legislators continue to put the power to shutter free speech into the hands of the executive branch. These bills are part of what is called the Cybersecurity Act of 2009, and they essentially give the President of the United States the power to shut down Internet sites he feels might compromise national security. The bills put forth the idea of creating a new office of the National Cybersecurity Advisor to protect the nation from cybercrime, espionage, and attack. The new Cybersecurity Advisor would report directly to the President. In the event of cyber attack, which is ill-defined in the proposed laws, the President, through this National Cybersecurity Advisor, would have the authority to disconnect critical infrastructure from the Internet, which would include citizens' banking and health records. According to an early draft of the bill, the Secretary of Commerce would have access to all privately owned information networks deemed critical to the nation without regard to any provision of law, regulation, rule, or policy restricting such access. In talks to Congress, Senator Rockefeller warned that we must protect our critical infrastructure at all costs. And the bill's co-sponsor, Maine Republican Senator Olympia Snow, said that failure to pass this law would risk a cyber Katrina. However, privacy advocates immediately attacked the legislation. Leslie Harris, the president of the Center for Democracy and Technology, stated, "The cybersecurity threat is real, but such a drastic federal intervention in private communications technology and networks could harm both security and privacy." Larry Seltzer, a technology writer for the Internet news source eWeek, agreed with Harris. "The whole thing smells bad to me. I don't like the chances of the government improving this situation by taking it over generally, and I definitely don't like the idea of politicizing this authority by putting it in the direct control of the president." Jennifer Granick, civil liberties director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said that by concentrating Internet control in one individual, the Internet could actually become less safe. When one person can access all information on a network, it makes it more vulnerable to intruders, argued Granick. You basically established a path for the bad guys to skip down. Granick added that the nonspecific scope of this legislation is contrary to what the Constitution promises us. Should the Commerce Department decide to use information gained while accessing critical infrastructure on the net against the user, privacy would be lost. According to Granick, this is a clear violation of the U.S. Constitution's Article 4, which states the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. "Who's interested in this legislation?" asked Granick. "Law enforcement and people in the security industry who want to ensure more government dollars go to them." Take a number. With high-powered technology and the right legislation in place, America is coming closer and closer to the totalitarian surveillance society that George Orwell described in 1984. Consider how the government has effectively enumerated the American citizenry over 50 years. 1935, Social Security initiated. 1936, the current Social Security numbering system begins. 1962, the IRS starts requiring Social Security numbers on tax returns, even though Social Security cards plainly state the number was not for identification. 1970, all banks require a Social Security number. 1971, military ID numbers are changed to Social Security numbers. 1982, anyone receiving government largesse is required to obtain a Social Security number. 1984, anyone being declared a dependent for IRS tax purposes needs a Social Security number. Within 2 years, even newborn babies were required to have a Social Security number under penalty of fine. Free people are individuals. Enslaved serfs are numbered chattel. If Americans are to remain a truly free people, tight restrictions must be placed on the microchipping of the population, as well as the frequency of times the state requires one to present a number for identification. At the rate things are going, George Orwell's 1984 vision of psychological and electronic tyranny is almost upon us. Homeland Security. If surveillance of the American public is being centralized, then it makes sense that the nation would need a more centralized law enforcement agency. In other words, a national police force. During his nearly 40-year career as director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover continuously argued against the need for a national police force. This may have been due more to maintaining the independence of his bureau than any personal regard for civil liberties. Yet Hoover's objection struck a chord with the majority of Americans. But with the hurried passage of a law creating the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, in November 2002, a nationalized police force was formed. This act was the greatest restructuring of the federal government since the National Security Act of 1947, yet this time it didn't include any of the previous act's deliberation and review. After 9/11, President Bush argued that this needed to be done rapidly because the country faced an urgent need and the government needed to move quickly before the end of the congressional session. Thus began the push to create the Department of Homeland Security, with Tom Ridge holding a cabinet-level position, controlling more than 170,000 federal employees and 22 federal agencies. Despite congressional misgivings, the Homeland Security Act passed speedily through Congress with little or no revision. In the U.S. Senate, the proposal to create the department passed on a 98-1 vote. One senator did not vote. As a side note, apparently senators were so confident that they were about to do a genuine service for America that they voted themselves a pay raise for the fourth consecutive year. The Homeland Security Bill was signed into law by President Bush on November 25, 2002. With the new office, Bush wanted to bring a myriad of government agencies under one central control. The agencies responsible for border, coastline, and transportation security were now under the command of the new office, and Bush remarked, "The continuing threat of terrorism, the threat of mass murder on our own soil, will be met with a unified, effective response." By 2006, Homeland Security encompassed more than 87,000 government jurisdictions at both the state and local level, with additional directorates carrying names both familiar and not, such as Preparedness, Science and Technology, Management, Policy, FEMA, the TSA, Customs, Border Patrol, the INS, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, the U.S. Coast Guard, and the Secret Service. Equally disturbing as Homeland Security's power was, the news that the Federal General Services Administration, GSA, had asked for $481.6 million in discretionary funds in its fiscal 2009 budget request, constituting a 103% increase from the $237.7 million in fiscal 2008. Legislators had earmarked the increase for the initial construction of a new DHS headquarters. Recently, the DHS announced it will consolidate most of its 60 offices spread across the Washington, D.C. region into a single new headquarters building that should cost $3 billion. The move into the new headquarters is scheduled to begin in 2011, with a 1.2 million square foot headquarters to be built in southeast Washington on the grounds of the closed St. Elizabeth's Hospital, ironically a former mental asylum. The project continued to invite controversy, with opposition coming from numerous area organizations and think tanks. Aside from the humorous nature of moving perhaps the most helter-skelter of all federal agencies onto the grounds of an old loony bin, this move is so shockingly idiotic that only the DHS could do it, wrote James Joyner, a former Army officer and editor for a nonpartisan group and publisher of Outside the Beltway, an online journal of politics and foreign affairs analysis. It was bad enough that the powers that be gave in to political pressure and headquartered DHS in D.C. proper rather than out in the much cheaper, more secure space in Chantilly, Virginia, as originally planned. But now they're consolidating their critical functions into a single building. Dispersion would save the taxpayer billions in cost of living and inordinately improve the quality of life of most DHS employees. Joyner added that from a security standpoint, it would seem to be more advantageous to disperse Homeland Security components rather than concentrate them all in one location. By 2010, the power of Homeland Security was being felt in even small police and sheriff's departments across the nation. Tax money flowed into them, providing everything from updated and interlinked computer systems to bulletproof vests, crowd control devices, and armored cars and helicopters. More vocal critics were noting the similarities between Homeland Security and the German Gestapo, which by 1935 had brought all of Nazi Germany's law enforcement agencies under its control and considered any person, regardless of their position in society, suspect. Could the consolidation of power within Homeland Security be a continuation of a plan to change America from a well-defended constitutional republic to a police state, a reincarnation of the German Gestapo? No one knows for certain. Immediately upon taking office, President Bush ordered all records of former presidents, including Reagan and those of his father, sealed from the public. Under Bush's executive order, even if an ex-president wants to release his papers to the public, the sitting president has the right to prevent their release. Although in April 2009, Obama did order some of Reagan's papers released from the National Archives, many remained kept from the public, including his own birth certificate and school records. He also fought to keep secret his White House visitor list. Due to this failure to act on his campaign pledge of transparency in government, by 2010, fears that a police state might be just around the corner were heightened. None of this is really new. Plans to shift America into a police state date back to 1984, when Reagan's National Security Council, NSC, drafted a plan to impose martial law in the United States through FEMA. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North helped author the plan, which in 1987 was leaked to the media. Arthur Lyman, then chief counsel of the Senate Iran-Contra Committee, declared in a memo that North was at the center of what amounted to a secret government within a government. Oddly, this is a term similar to Bush's shadow government. At the same time, officials said North's involvement in the proposed plan to radically alter the American government by executive order was proof that he was involved in a wide range of secret activities, foreign and domestic, that went far beyond the Iran-Contra scandal. North's shadow government plan called for suspension of the Constitution and turning control of the government over to the little-known FEMA. Military commanders would be appointed to run state and local governments. In the event of a crisis such as nuclear war, violent and widespread internal dissent, or national opposition to a U.S. military invasion abroad, the government would declare martial law. When he drafted these plans, North was the NSC's liaison to FEMA. Many people are bothered by the idea of being placed under martial law in the event of widespread internal dissent, especially when they look at the continuation of many of Bush's policies under Obama. North's contingency plan was to be part of an executive order or legislative package that Reagan would sign but hold secretly with the NSC until such time as a crisis arose. It was never revealed whether Reagan had signed the plan. When Bush took office, sealed Reagan's records from the public, and moved to create the Homeland Security Department, former Nixon counselor John Dean warned that America was sliding into a constitutional dictatorship and martial law. Further concerns were voiced by Timothy H. Edgar, legislative counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. In testimony to various congressional committees, Edgar noted that the Homeland Security Department would have substantial powers and more armed federal agents with arrest authority than any other government agency. He questioned whether the new department would have structural and legal safeguards to keep it open and accountable to the public. Unfortunately, legislation to create the Homeland Security Department not only fails to provide such safeguards, it eviscerates many of the safeguards that are available throughout the government and have worked well to safeguard the public interest, stated Edgar. He then enumerated problem areas within the proposed Homeland Security Department, saying it undermines the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, by allowing the various agencies to decide on their own which documents should be made public, and it limits citizen input by exempting advisory committees to Homeland Security from the Federal Advisory Committee Act, FACA. Passed in 1972, FACA was designed to ensure openness, accountability, and the balance of viewpoints in government advisory groups. Edgar also argued that, by allowing the Secretary of Homeland Security to make his own personnel rules, the Homeland Security Department would silence whistleblowers protected under the Federal Whistleblower Protection Act, WPA. Last, the HSD might threaten personal privacy and constitutional freedoms because the vague wording in the Homeland Security Act does not provide sufficient guarantees. The ACLU Council was also hugely concerned by plans to combine the CIA and the FBI under Homeland Security. The CIA and other agencies that gather foreign intelligence abroad operate in the largely lawless environment, noted Edgar. To bring these agencies into the same organization as the FBI risks further damage to Americans' civil liberties. Edgar added, "No one wants to repeat the J. Edgar Hoover era, when the FBI, under the infamous COINTELPRO, was used to collect information about and disrupt the activities of civil rights leaders and others whose ideas Hoover disdained." Moreover, during the Clinton administration, the Filegate matter involving the improper transfer of sensitive information from FBI background checks of prominent Republicans to the White House generated enormous public concern that private security-related information was being used for political purposes. Congress should not provide a future administration with the temptation to use information available in Homeland Security Department files to the detriment of its political enemies. No-fly list. Information about Homeland Security's information databases became public when news spread about its no-fly lists of people suspected of terrorist connections. By early 2006, this list included 325,000 names, compiled from more than 26 terrorism-related databases from the intelligence and law enforcement communities. "We have lists that are having baby lists at this point," commented Timothy Sparapani, a former legislative attorney for privacy rights at the American Civil Liberties Union. "If we have over 300,000 known terrorists who want to do this country harm, we've got a bigger problem than deciding which names go on which list, but I highly doubt this is the case." In early 2006, Alberto Gonzalez, then Attorney General, tried to assure members of the Senate Judiciary Committee that information is collected, information is retained, and information is disseminated in a way to protect the privacy interests of all Americans. But Gonzalez had a hard time convincing the late Senator Edward Kennedy, a committee member who was prevented from flying five times in March 2004 because a T. Kennedy appeared on the DHS's no-fly list. In Washington, Boston, and other cities, airline employees refused to issue Kennedy a boarding pass because his name was on the no-fly list. Kennedy was delayed multiple times until supervisors were called and approved his travel. Even after supposedly clearing up the mistakes in names, Kennedy was stopped again from flying in 2004, mostly at Boston's Logan International Airport. Banned from flying, even in his hometown, prompted a personal telephone apology from Homeland Secretary Tom Ridge. That a clerical error could land one of the most powerful people in Washington to the list, it makes one wonder just how many others who are not terrorists are on the list, commented senior ACLU counsel Reginald T. Shuford. Someone of Senator Kennedy's stature can simply call a friend to have his name removed, but a regular American citizen does not have that ability. He had to call three times himself. Alarmingly, Timothy Edgar's fears that the lists will be used for political vengeance may already be realized. Arizona State Treasurer Dean Martin told a local TV journalist that in 2009, his name suddenly appeared on the government's no-fly list after former Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano became head of the DHS. Martin claims the blacklisting may be based on his past political rivalry with Napolitano. My staff used to joke after my disagreements with the previous governor that I wouldn't be able to fly once she got back in D.C., Martin said. I didn't believe them, but it's actually happening. Another incident involved Dr. Robert Johnson, a heart surgeon in upstate New York and a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, who had served during the time of the first Gulf War. In early 2006, when he arrived at a Syracuse airport for a flight, he was barred and told he was on the federal no-fly list as a possible terror suspect. Why would a former lieutenant colonel who swore an oath to defend and protect our country pose a threat of terrorism? Johnson asked a local newspaper. Johnson speculated that he was placed on the list because in 2004, as a Democrat, he had challenged Republican Representative John McHugh for his 23rd District congressional seat. The colonel also had been an outspoken critic of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Like many other citizens who find themselves on the no-fly list, Johnson is demanding answers as to who decides which name goes on the list and how someone like him can get off. By 2010, the TSA's Terrorist Identification Data Mart Environment, TIDE, the intelligence community's central repository of information on known and suspected international terrorists, had grown to more than 500,000 persons. But that was not the worst of it. On Christmas Day, 2009, a 23-year-old Nigerian, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, allegedly tried to set off explosive powder hidden in his undergarments aboard Northwest Flight 253, becoming known as the Underwear Bomber. It was big news at the time, but after more facts about the event surfaced, the whole episode began to accrue a nasty smell. Other passengers told how Abdulmutallab was escorted by a well-dressed man who talked his way past airline employees, despite the fact that Abdulmutallab had only carry-on bags and had paid cash for the transatlantic flight to Detroit. Additionally, Abdulmutallab's father, Alhaji Umaru Mutallab, former chairman of First Bank Nigeria and a former Nigerian minister, had reported his son's militant activities to the U.S. Embassy and Nigerian security agencies 6 months before the incident. Then, during a January 2000 session of the House Committee on Homeland Security, it was found out that U.S. intelligence agencies had prevented the State Department from revoking Abdulmutallab's U.S. visa, a move that would have prevented him from boarding the plane. Patrick F. Kennedy, an undersecretary for management at the State Department, said intelligence officials asked his agency not to deny a visa to the suspected terrorist because they felt it might have hampered an investigation into al-Qaeda. Others saw the action as evidence that elements within intelligence agencies had paved the way for Abdul-Muttalib. Another problem for this story was that reports stated Abdul-Muttalib had attempted to ignite pentaerythritol tetranitrate, PETN, an explosive used by the U.S. military. Persons familiar with PETN said a blasting cap, not simple fire from a match or lighter, is required to detonate PETN. No blasting caps or primers were found on Abdul-Muttalib, and the chemicals he carried were inadequate to generate an explosion, leading conspiracy researchers to suspect that the whole episode was another false flag attack, one engineered to cast blame on others rather than the real culprits. But what could have been the purpose? It is possible that Congress needed the new terrorist scare to coincide with the debate over rescinding some Patriot Act measures. After all, the measures were continued. Also, following the terrorist scare, existing plans to equip major airports with full-body scanning devices went into high gear, alongside a public relations blitz by former Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, co-founder of the Chertoff Group, a security and risk management firm whose clients include Rapiscan, a manufacturer of the body imaging screening machines, 150 of which were purchased by the TSA for $25 million in early 2010. Mr. Chertoff should not be allowed to abuse the trust the public has placed in him as a former public servant to privately gain from the sale of full-body scanners under the pretense that the scanners would have detected this particular type of explosive, PETN, said Kate Haney, founder of FlyersRights.org, an airport passengers' rights group opposed to the use of the full-body scanners. In January 2010, about 40 body scanners were in use at 19 U.S. airports. This number was expected to climb to more than 300 machines by the end of that year, mostly due to the publicity over the Christmas Day incident. Despite Chertoff's claim that scanners could have detected PETN, Ben Wallace, a member of Parliament, who formerly had worked on developing such scanners for airport use, told newsmen that trials had shown such low-density materials as PETN would not show up on scanners anyway. Wallace said scanners picked up shrapnel, heavy wax, and metal, but the scanners missed plastic, chemicals, and liquids. Peeping TSA. Other concerns over the full-body scanners involved health and privacy. The tetrahertz radiation waves used in body scanners penetrate non-conducting material like clothing, but also deposit energy in the human body. Boyan Alexandrov, heading a team of researchers at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, announced they found that tetrahertz radiation used in the full-body scanners damages human DNA. Based on our results, we argue that a specific tetrahertz radiation exposure may significantly affect the natural dynamics of DNA and thereby influence intricate molecular processes involved in gene expression and DNA replication, they reported. The team said that while tetrahertz produces only tiny resonant effects, it nevertheless allows tetrahertz waves to unzip double-stranded DNA, creating bubbles in the double strand that may significantly interfere with normal processes such as gene expression and DNA replication. Such subtle changes may explain why evidence of damage has been so hard to find. According to Alexandrov's team, ordinary resonant effects are not powerful enough to do this kind of DNA damage, but nonlinear resonances can. Not only is health a concern, but so is privacy. Many privacy advocates claim the TSA was not being truthful when its officials said that scanning machines cannot clearly show an individual's genitalia, and certainly in all media stories on the machine, one can only see blurry outlines of the body. However, alternative media such as PrisonPlanet.com exposed the TSA statement as untrue when it quoted Melbourne Airport's Office of Transport Security Manager Cheryl Johnson, who admitted, "It is possible to see genitals and breasts while they're going through the machine. It will show the private parts of people, but what we've decided is that we're not going to blur those out because it severely limits the detection capabilities." In England, where full-body scanning has been declared mandatory, although it violates UK child pornography laws against the depiction of the genitals of underage children, opponents have declared the images so graphic that they amount to virtual strip searching. They called for more safeguards to protect passengers' privacy. Paul Joseph Watson, a reporter for PrisonPlanet.com, said examples sent in by the website's readers confirmed that by simply inverting some of the pictures produced by body scanners, one can create a near-perfect replica of a naked body in full color. The inverting process, available in most image editing software, simply changes an indistinct negative image to a clear positive one. Airport screeners will have access to huge high-definition images that, once inverted, will allow them to see every minute detail of your body, noted Watson. While TSA officials tried to assure the public that flyers' naked images will not be saved, printed, or transmitted, government documents obtained by the Washington-based Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, told a different story. The documents showed that the TSA specifies that body scanners must have the ability to store and send images when in test mode. EPIC Executive Director Mark Rotenberg said such a requirement makes it possible for the machines to be abused by TSA insiders and even hacked by outsiders. "I don't think the TSA has been forthcoming with the American public about the true capability of these devices," says Rotenberg. "They've done a bunch of very slick promotions where they show people, including journalists, going through the devices. And then they reassure people, based on the images that have been produced, that there's not any privacy concerns. But if you look at the actual technical specifications and you read the vendor contracts, you come to understand that these machines are capable of doing far more than the TSA has let on." Official assurances that full body scans would be seen only by the necessary airport authorities and quickly destroyed were shattered in February 2010 when the BBC revealed that Indian actor Shahrukh Khan had passed through a body scan and later had the image of his naked body printed out and circulated by female security staffers at Heathrow. "You walk into the machine and everything, the whole outline of your body, comes out," said Khan. "I was a little scared. And I came out. Then I saw these girls, they had these printouts. I looked at them. I thought they were some form you had to fill. I said, 'Give them to me.' And you could see everything inside. So I autographed them for them." It's not just body scanning machines that conjure up images of a 1984 Orwellian techno society. Security abuses. Although popular belief holds that those with Middle Eastern names are most susceptible to being detained by the government, the Secret Service considered Robert Lee Bob on the Job Lewis enough of a threat to arrest him on the basis of an offhand remark. Lewis is a fervent Christian who has spent decades researching government scandals and worked with airline lawyers during the investigation of the bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. In April 1998, Lewis was in a restaurant in Houston, Texas, regaling waiters with his knowledge of government skullduggery and little reported information of former President George H.W. Bush. Lewis admitted he made a remark about Bush along the lines of, "I'll have his ass." Secret Service agent Tim Riley was sitting in the restaurant near Lewis and promptly placed Lewis under arrest for threatening the former president. The next day, in a short hearing, Federal Magistrate Marcia Crone avoided any First Amendment issue and instead accepted the hearsay testimony of Agent Riley. Because Lewis did not have enough money to post bail, he was held for nearly a year in federal custody. During this time, he was sent to the Fort Worth Federal Correctional Institution and was placed in the cell where Whitewater scandal figure James McDougal reportedly committed suicide. Lewis knew who McDougal had been and felt his placement there was a form of intimidation. Some months later, Lewis was transferred to a federal hospital in Springfield, Missouri, where he was involuntarily drugged until letters from journalists and academic contacts protesting his drugging gained him a release. There was never a court trial or even an adversarial hearing in the case. For anyone who thinks that the DHS's abuse of power might stop over time, consider this 2006 story from Bethesda, Maryland. Two uniformed men wearing baseball caps with the words Homeland Security on them walked into the Little Falls Library and loudly announced that the viewing of pornography was forbidden. Then they asked one library internet user to step outside. After complaints were lodged against the two security officers, Montgomery County Chief Administrative Officer Bruce Romer stated that the two officers were members of the Security Division of Montgomery County's Homeland Security Department, an unarmed unit charged with patrolling about 300 county buildings. He added that this group was not tasked with seeking out pornography and that the incident was unfortunate and regrettable. Romer said the two officers had overstepped their authority and had been reassigned. To illustrate the ease with which a TSA employee can impact a person's life, just consider the experience of Rebecca Solomon, a 22-year-old University of Michigan student. On January 5, 2010, she was stopped in an airport by a TSA agent who pretended to find a bag of white powder in her carry-on computer bag. The man then demanded to know where she had gotten the powder and, as the student stood in shock, proceeded to wave the bag in front of her and said he was just kidding. "You should have seen the look on your face," the TSA man told her, laughing. When this incident was made public, the TSA said the agent was no longer with the agency. But if the TSA man had not admitted it was a joke, Solomon would still be behind bars somewhere. This small incident should be a sobering example to any thinking American of unwarranted and unsupervised power. Such incidents, of course, illustrate the ease with which persons of authority can abuse that authority. It also begs the question of how many other HSD employees overstepped their authority and how many other such stories never make it to the public. Photographers under fire. Apparently, even traditional American activities such as taking pictures around town are not exempt from the scrutiny of Homeland Security enforcers. Amateur photographer Mike McGinnis was intrigued by all the activity around Denver's Adams Mark Hotel in early December 2002, which was surrounded by Denver police, Army Rangers, and rooftop snipers. McGinnis, who works in information technology and frequently shoots photos of corporate buildings and communications equipment, took a few snapshots. He was then confronted by a Denver policeman who demanded his camera. When he refused to hand over his expensive Nikon F2, he was pushed to the ground and arrested. After being held in a Denver police station, McGinnis was interrogated by a Secret Service agent. McGinnis learned that Vice President Cheney was staying in the area and that he was being charged as a terrorist under the Patriot Act. According to McGinnis, the agent tried to make him confess to being a terrorist and called him a raghead collaborator and dirty pinko faggot. After being held for several hours, McGinnis was released without explanation. When McGinnis's attorney contacted the Denver police for an explanation, they denied ever arresting McGinnis. The website photographernotaterrorist.org proclaimed, "Photography is under attack. Across the country, it seems that anyone with a camera is being targeted as a potential terrorist, whether amateur or professional, whether landscape, architectural, or street photographer. Not only is it corrosive of press freedom, but creation of the collective visual history of our country is extinguished by anti-terrorist legislation designed to protect the heritage it prevents us recording. This campaign is for everyone who values visual imagery, not just photographers. We must work together now to stop this before photography becomes a part of history rather than a way of recording it." In early 2009, David Preber, photo editor for the Central Illinois newspaper The Pantograph, was stripped of his camera's memory card and threatened with arrest after he took a photo of the police in a shootout with a gunman. Preber recovered the memory card more than 3 hours later after complaining to a sheriff's department supervisor who was an acquaintance. After the supervisor contacted the state police, Preber's memory card was returned with apologies. His photo of the gunman was published on the internet, garnering more than 1.2 million page views during the first 32 hours. However, Preber learned that the police had made a DVD of his photos, which he claimed they had no legal right to do. In 2007, Carlos Miller, a Miami freelance photographer, was arrested, tried, and sentenced for photographing Miami police officers on a public street. Miller was found not guilty of disobeying a police officer and disorderly conduct, but was convicted of resisting arrest. The prosecution recommended 3 months of probation, 50 hours of community service, anger management classes, and court costs. But the presiding judge, Jose Fernandez of Miami's county court, was apparently angered that Miller had documented his trial on an internet blog and sentenced Miller to 1 year of probation, 100 hours of community service, anger management classes, and more than $500 in court costs. The severity of Miller's sentence upset the Society of Professional Journalists, SPJ, which had initially donated some funds for Miller's defense. In a news release, SPJ President Clint Brewer said, "The fact that Mr. Miller was arrested for taking pictures in a public place was the first violation of his First Amendment rights. Those rights were violated again when Mr. Miller's statements in his blog became factors in Fernandez's sentence. The Society fully defends Mr. Miller's right to speak freely in his blog." Even after leaving the scene of a photo opportunity, apparently photographers today are still susceptible to raids by the authorities. In September 2009, Laura Sennett, a photojournalist specializing in protests and demonstrations, filed a federal complaint stating that both the federal government and local law enforcement violated her rights under the First and Fourth Amendments after coming into her home and seizing computer hardware and data, digital cameras, memory cards, a still camera, digital storage devices, and a digital voice recorder, along with other work materials and personal belongings. Only her son was home at the time of the raid. According to Sennett, this happened because she photographed protesters at a meeting of the International Monetary Fund on April 12, 2008. In her complaint, Sennett claimed to have suffered extreme emotional and mental distress and humiliation. She sought an injunction ordering the DOJ to return her belongings, plus pay $250,000 in compensatory damages and $1 million in punitive damages. No criminal charges were filed against her. Sennett named Attorney General Eric Holder, the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, Prince William, the Police Department of Arlington Counties, and the Department of Justice in her complaint. Sennett says she was not a target of any criminal investigation, and her work has been published by several media outlets, including CNN and the History Channel. One of the long-standing tenets of journalism is that in reporting the news, both film, video, and still photographers have the right to shoot pictures, especially on public property. This right appears in grave danger as news reporting today already is limited to handouts from the authorities. Reporters being held behind yellow tape blocks from the scene, and duplicate TV coverage on most channels coming from pool cameramen. You're on camera. It's not just the photographers who are having concerns over cameras. Recently, there has been an explosion in the number of surveillance cameras being used in cities small and large that perturbs libertarians. Instead of a conventional welcome sign outside the city of Medina, Washington, visitors today are greeted by one reading, "You are entering a 24-hour video surveillance area." Police Chief Jeffrey Chen declined to say how many cameras had been installed at intersections using automatic license plate recognition technology to record license numbers. Should a database search turn up an outstanding warrant, police immediately dispatch units to track the car. Chen said information gathered by the cameras is stored for 60 days, which allows police to keep searching if a crime occurs. These cameras provide us with intelligence, explained Chen. It gets us in front of criminals. I don't like to be on a level playing field with criminals. Chen told newsmen that in 2008, there were 11 burglaries in this town of 3,100, which boasts an average household income of more than $220,000. Some people think 11 burglaries is tolerable, but even one crime is intolerable, Chen said. Doug Honig, a spokesman for the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington, was troubled by the new surveillance system, saying it smacks of privacy violations. Government shouldn't be keeping records of people's comings and goings when they haven't done anything wrong, he said. By actions like this, we're moving closer and closer to a surveillance society. Despite Honig's statements, many believe that intrusive measures are necessary today. Former Washington, D.C. Mayor Anthony A. Williams is among the believers, and he warned his constituents when he was mayor that we are in a new, really dangerous world now, and we have to maintain a higher level of security. Williams planned to increase Washington, D.C. security by emulating cities like London and Sydney that have thousands of video cameras throughout the city linked to a central command office. England currently has more than 2 million cameras in airports, train stations, streets, and neighborhoods. Asked if such a scheme would seriously impact individual civil rights, Williams admitted, there will be trade-offs. The United Kingdom is a great example of a modern surveillance society, where companies can thrive on a citizen's penchant for voyeurism. A new company called Internet Eyes offers up to £1,000 to citizen volunteers who stay at home watching several video monitors connected to some of Britain's ubiquitous surveillance cameras. As part of this instant event notification system, the viewers are to report any alert, a suspicious activity, which according to company literature most commonly includes shoplifting, burglary, vandalism, and antisocial behavior. The alerts are passed to the camera owners, subscribers to the Internet Eyes service, who evaluate the alerts and decide who gets the reward money. Monitors cannot designate or control the video camera feeds, nor are they allowed to know the location of the cameras. How long will it be before some new terrorist threat, whether real, imagined, or fabricated, enlists well-meaning American television viewers to report anything they feel is suspicious behavior on the part of their neighbors? Don't think it cannot happen. It's already happening in what once was called the Mother Country.